Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to Goblet of Wine, a Drunken Harry Potter podcast. I'm Charlie.
And I'm Hannah, and we're two 20-somethings rereading our favourite childhood book, but this time with added alcohol and cynicism.
Today's episode, we're chatting about chapter 29 of Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince.
So grab your favourite Taylor Swift-themed cocktail and join us on this drunken, reminiscent journey.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm holding a spoon. We're starting with the drinks today, which we don't normally do, but it's because time is of the essence.
Charlie's very anxious about this.
It's going to turn...
She kept being like, get in the room!
It's going to turn purple. Okay, we're doing Taylor Swift themed drinks.
Do you want me to read out the entire message after the drink?
After.
Okay, fine.
Mine is Cherry Lips Crystal Skies, but I think it is just going to go purple. So I've done a frozen... I'll do the exact thing after. Frozen cherry... with a crystal skies. I'm gonna try and make it not just immediately go purple. We shall see. Hold it up.
I don't know what's happening.
So I think doing the spoon helps it not.
It's too
frozen. Oh no, it's not coming out.
It's too frozen.
It's not coming out! What? Oh god. No, careful!
Stuff.
It's going so well. Oh.
Looks like the West Ham colours.
Woo! Football!
Heart.
Oh, I've lost my spoon. Oh no! Everything's gone wrong! Ah! No! Drink it!
No!
Drink it all back in the thing.
I have... Oh no, I have to wash it. It's so sticky. No!
I should be a professional barista. So this is... Cherry Lips, Crystal Skies.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, I specifically told Hannah I needed straws and the vile wench got me no straws. Okay, so specifically the red side of it is frozen cherries, frozen Coca-Cola, not frozen rum, lime juice and crushed ice, and the blue is ice, vodka, blue curacao and lemonade. Might taste disgusting and it will definitely end up purple, but...
This room's going to get so sticky. Mm. It tastes like a slushy.
I mean, it basically
it is.
I don't know what drink I'm tasting. I feel like the blue doesn't taste of much because I didn't... It was a lot of ice to try and get it to the right consistency that it wouldn't just merge with the red. So, and I didn't taste test it. So I think the drink will get nicer once we're past the blue.
How exciting. So what's the blue? I wasn't listening.
It's essentially a blue lagoon. It's... ice, vodka, blue curacao, and lemonade.
Nice.
This is very refreshing.
It's very refreshing. But this is the West Ham colours.
No, it's Cherry Lips Crystal Skies.
It also almost looks like Boppenheimer nails.
So, this is a request from our producer level patron, Meg. Meg says, despite being someone who listens to an alcohol-related podcast, I am vastly uneducated on this topic. So this is a choose-your-own-adventure type request. Can you each please choose a Taylor Swift song? So you haven't actually said what your song is. You've only said the lyric.
Blank space.
And create a cocktail that matches the vibe of that song. It could be your favourite Taylor songs or just one that inspire you to create something fun. What a great request. Thank you, Meg. So yeah, you came up with this and I'll do mine halfway through because...
this is made of ice, so it has to be done first. We've done things so out of order, I don't know where to go next.
How are you?
Oh, the cherry bit's nice. I just got a bit of cherry.
I'm finding it difficult to drink this drink. I really wish in that pub we were just in, I'd remembered to steal some straws.
I did tell you, like, Tuesday.
Yeah, you did, and I chose to not write down the bit that said straws.
This is a clear attempt at sabotage, I think we can agree. I might make the poll whose drink seemed the nicest, and when you guys vote, I want you to take into consideration the blatant attempt at sabotage that has gone on here.
I actually was trying to wash a straw for you, but you told me to stop and get in this room.
Because it was frozen and I didn't want it to turn purple.
Do you want me to go and carry on cleaning your straw?
No.
How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. I have nothing to report since we last recorded, I don't think.
We saw Barbie Oppie yesterday.
Barbie was incredible. Oppenheimer was also good, but obviously Barbie is the superior film.
Yes, genuinely. It was fucking fantastic. It was brilliant. I don't think I've scream laughed like that at a film in fuck knows how long.
I like fully cry laughed at one point. Like fully, not just like a tear, like sobbing, couldn't watch the next scene probably because I had cry laughed so much.
I'm Bella Bye.
I went to France. Mm-hmm. I came back from France. I went to your house in Suffolk.
Mm-hmm. We had a lovely time.
We went on a tiny boat.
We did go on a tiny boat.
Yep.
Yep. I'm much the same. I did all the same things as her because, you know.
You didn't come to France.
Oh, no.
You don't like the French.
I actually did come to France and I followed you around the entire time, just in a moustache.
Oh, good Lord.
With a baguette.
With a baguette. Right. You know that thing where it's like, oh, it's stereotypical that French people carry a baguette around. They don't really do that. At least 7 times a day, I saw people walking along with a baguette under their arm. Yeah, I was like, this is not stereotypical. The French are walking around with baguettes under their arm.
That was me.
How are you?
Same old, same old. Oh, we're testing some new equipment. We got a new mixing desk.
I think it looks less technical than the last one because it has a big coloured button.
It's so colourful. We will insert a photo here over Hannah's face.
She says, why would I do that when I'm editing? I'm going to put it over your face. Please, I'm going to put it over your...
Don't
touch my lips. It's apparently more technical than the other one, but I think it looks like a giant toy.
It's really sexy. It's got colourful lights. It's got presets for microphones. And we can actually... Because our last one was like slightly broken, so we could only record onto one track, which meant that Hannah's death breathing just had to remain. And now we can cut out Hannah's...
I can cut that out when it's going over Charlie's audio.
Exactly.
What does the red button do? What does the yellow button do? What does the orange button do? What does the green button do? What did that do?
Hang on, did that actually... We don't have the headphones on, so I can't tell. If this is just doing endless sound effects that I can't pick up on. Let me see if I can... Oh no, I'd have to like... Oh, actually, okay. But then... Did that do it?
Well, it's got a sound wave. Oh no, that's the same as me talking. It's me. Hi. I'm the problem. Just let it play through.
I really hope that there is just loads of sound effects. But anyway, once we actually set it up, we can have sound effects if we want. Anyways, what else do we normally do?
Patrons. A leprechaun size thank you to Lisanne.
An atomic bomb size thank you to Adriana.
A polka dot size thank you to Dottie D.
A Voldemort size thank you to Vendi.
A President Kennedy size thank you to Heaven Kennedy.
An Estonia size thank you to Esme.
Thank you all for joining the Patreon. We just recorded an episode that we call bad advice, but it was mostly good advice, apart from when someone asked us how to hide a body, which I'm not sure you can ever I'm not sure you can ever give good advice to the question, how do you hide a body?
I mean, I'm glad we can't. I'm sure someone can, but I would be concerned. It would also be very dumb of us if we could, we actually did. You know, maybe we do know perfectly how to hide a body, but it would not be wise for us to advertise the fact that we know that. Questions! A few episodes we asked, who would your Harry Potter fan cast be? Some little shit replied, one man show, Neil is everyone. Please stop contributing to this man's ego.
Someone said Timothy Chalamet. Yes, he's American. Sorry, as young Tom Riddle. Please stop casting Timothy Chalamet in things.
I really dislike him.
Same. I don't get why everyone's obsessed with him.
No.
I really don't get Timothy Chalamet hype.
I really, really don't.
Are you reading?
By Hannah Braggins. Yeah, yeah.
You can't tell the difference even when we're on video? Come on.
Someone said, not an answer, but was listening to Hannah talk only to look at the video and see it was Charlie. Can one of you develop an accent? Please, I've been failing for years now and I'm never going to get it.
You're better at accents than me.
Och, hi, the new.
I'm not developing an accent. I can't believe you can't get it even with video.
Someone says, your mum.
I know the classic is Ben Barnes as Sirius, but I headcan Sirius as gender fluid person, so 100% my fanciest Sirius would be some kind of gender queer actor. That's fun.
I know not a single actor. I live under a rock.
Mood. Yeah, because I'm reading through this and I'm like, can't read that, I don't know who it is. Can't read that, I don't know who it is. Someone else says, Ben Barnes as Sirius. Classic, but Ben Barnes is says he's relatively young Sirius.
Richard Madden as James Potter. For some reason, I dislike Richard Madden.
I love Richard Madden. Ben Barnes as Sirius and Andrew Garfield as Remus. Louis Partridge as Harry. Don't know who that is.
Those are some great responses. You're still flicking.
I just don't... I feel the mood of I know not a single actor, I live under a rock, because I don't know who half these people are.
Yeah, everyone always says Ben Barnes and I'm like, I don't.
I know who it is because people say it all the time, but I don't actually know what he's been in. Chapter 29, The Phoenix Lament.
My first note was Harry doesn't want to leave Dumbly's body oddy oddy.
Body oddy oddy.
Body oddy oddy.
Oi, oi, oi. My first one was, Ginny. So Ginny manages to get him to leave, which raised two questions. One, how does Ginny know to go out there? How does she know Harry's there? No one else knew. And two, I'm so glad we learned the fact that Ginny's perfume lasted throughout an entire battle. Can I get what perfume she's wearing? Because I can't get a single perfume to last that long. I didn't put any on today.
I was going to say, because I can't smell.
I didn't put any on today, sorry.
I didn't either.
Oh. But yeah, like, I know you can't smell your own perfume a lot of the time because you get used to it, but Harry's like, oh, we only recognise it was Ginny because the flowery smell. I'm like, it's like 2 o'clock in the morning and she's fought in a battle. Is her perfume really still on?
Maybe that's just her natural whiff.
You think she sweats flowers?
Yes.
Great.
She's that perfect.
Yeah. She's just like that girl.
Yeah, she really is.
She's Barbie.
Yeah, she's never had a yeast infection in her life.
Ginny confirms that nobody else is dead. And then Harry goes, and then Ginny's like, oh, but Bill. And Harry's like, what? And Ginny's like, oh, he's like really injured. Don't worry, he's not dead. And Harry goes, are you sure? Like, I don't know. Yeah, maybe Ginny hasn't actually checked whether her brother is alive or not. Like, what do you mean, are you sure?
She's like, oh, fuck, yeah, I forgot.
Yeah,
actually, no,
actually,
he did die.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Now you've said, are you sure? I've realised my brother is in fact dead.
Yeah.
But Bill's not dead. He was attacked by Greyback and his face is unrecognisably torn up. Which, like, I really don't think the films did a good job of. They just kind of put, like, two lines down his face and he was like, Greyback.
Yeah.
Which they also didn't show it in the sixth film, so what was the fucking point of putting that in?
Yeah.
But, like, the books describe him as looking like Mad-Eye Moody, like, flaps of his face fucking hanging off.
Poor Bill.
Yeah. Like, proper mangled. The others, again, this made me question how Ginny knew to go out to the grounds to find Harry, because they go to the hospital wing where everyone is gathered around Bill's bed and none of them know that Dumbledore is dead. Like, this is news to all of them. And I really like Ron in this moment. Like, we've brought up a lot how Dumbledore is, like, obviously extremely manipulative and, like, whether that's for the good or not, he just is of the people around him. And Ron is standing there going, where's Dumbledore? I need him here now. It is his fault Bill is mangled. It was on Dumbledore's order, so bring him here now to help. Like, and I like that fight from Ron, that he doesn't idealize Dumbledore in the same way Harry does. In this moment, he's like, he told my brother to fight so he can fucking come here and sort it out.
It is kind of wild that clearly, like, Ginny knew what had happened to her brother and she's like, I'm just gonna go on a walk and find my boyfriend. Like, bitch, how codependent are you? Like,
yeah, presumably she was just going on a walk and kind of followed the stream of people out to the front.
I feel like you wouldn't just go on a walk when your brother was
Like, I don't know. Sometimes you need, like, different people react to things in different ways. Sometimes you're like, I need air. Yeah, and then she was like, where's everyone going?
I feel
but
like
it is a bit convenient.
I feel like she was looking for Harry.
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, everyone's just like, oh, there he is. Like, yeah, actually, did you not wonder where he'd gone? He could be, like, dead in the grounds, to be fair. Harry then has to explain what happened, and he's starting to explain everything when he stops because a phoenix begins to sing. And I love the words, his own grief turned magically to song. It's very beautiful and like a good way of writing about when your grief is encapsulated in a song. And sometimes you can't, like, sometimes grief can be so strong you can't articulate it, and then you hear a piece of music or a song or a poem or some form of medium and you're like, oh, okay, other people have experienced this and this is how it feels from an outside perspective.
Do you think Misu will sing when you die?
Yes.
Exactly that. I think Todd will beatbox.
Realistically, both cats, if we died alone in the house, would just munch on our dead bodies, because that's what cats do.
I mean, Todd tries to when I'm still alive. So.
And Todd tries to do it to me as well.
Yeah. Todd really hated Hannah last time he saw her.
Todd hissed at me.
Yeah.
Many times.
And he doesn't really hiss. I hate the Fantastic Beasts films for a lot of reasons, but they've really just made me not able to take the Phoenix thing seriously.
Yeah.
The whole, Phoenixes find Dumbledore's. I'm like, in a way, I can't articulate why, but just something about that being a thing kind of ruins it for me. I prefer it when it's just like...
See, that hadn't crossed my mind, so could you please stop ruining things for me by bringing in Fantastic Beasts lore?
Sorry.
It's not canon!
No, I know, but like, it just... I prefer it when it's like... He was just a good pet and a good owner, yeah. And this is just him honouring him, as opposed to it being like, phoenixes have this weird obsession with this one random family for some reason.
This is a phoenix finding a Dumbledore.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no, I hadn't thought of that, and now it's, yeah, I it's hate awesome. That. Because, like, yeah, we know that Dumbledore is, like, canonically, like, 150 years old. It hasn't been said in the book how long Fawkes has been with him, but obviously it's implied, like, a very, very long time. And something I had never considered until kind of, I guess, the first time I read this chapter and every time I read this chapter since, is how heartbreaking it must be to be a phoenix, because you can love an owner and be so loyal to an owner, but you will always outlive your owner. Because I suppose what's... every time the phoenix is reborn, it's always Fawkes, right? So that implies it's always the same animal, it always has the same memories, characteristics, and personality. So a phoenix will see every owner it ever has die, knowing that it will always outlive them.
Yeah.
And that's really heartbreaking.
Yeah, and they probably don't have, like, a great concept of death either. They're probably like, mate, we're...
What? Why don't you just come back? What?
Come back, dude. You've been a bit dramatic.
Just burst out as a baby again.
Like, I know you fell out a window, but, like, get over it.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder what their concept is of death, or whether they're so wise they kind of know that. It's one of those things which, like, I've never understood why in Twilight it is seen as a good thing to be immortal. Like, all the characters we care about become immortal. Immortality sounds like the worst thing I can ever imagine.
Yeah.
Even if most people you love are also immortal, God, I couldn't stand to be immortal. Like,
yeah, I wouldn't want it, but, like, I don't hate the interpretation, like, in Sarah J. Maas's novels, where it's like, they can be killed, but it's just that they, you know, they don't get to, like, 90 and go from old age. Like,
yeah.
I quite like that as a thing. Like, they can die, but, like, they just don't have, like, the human lifespan. But
I suppose that's technically what it is in Twilight. Like, a vampire can be killed.
Yeah. But, like, I hate this idea of, like, whenever it's in something where it's like, they literally cannot die. I'm like, okay, so, like, in billions of years or whatever, when, like, the universe doesn't exist or something, are you just, like, a conscience just, like, floating about? Like, that's fucking torture.
But, like, that's why I've always liked phoenixes, because I think there is this element of sadness to them. Like, I think they're portrayed quite well as an incredible but sad creature, whereas I never understand fantasy novels that use human mortality. Human immortality is a goal.
Yeah. Name of the Wind spoilers, if you care, skip a few seconds ahead. But, and this is kind of like super explicitly like said, but it's kind of what you add up and stuff. But there's like a character in that that's like, I mean, they're not like a character such as more like a figure that's like talked about in stories and stuff. And
right.
The story behind the character is that they like had this, you know, epic love of their life. She became ill. He tried to make himself so powerful to save her. Couldn't save her, but at that point had become so powerful that he could not die. And now he's like the big villain because he's basically just trying to destroy the world because he's like, this is the only way I can die if I just like destroy everything, because he's so like does not want to be alive anymore. I don't know, it's more interesting to be like things and people that are immortal. I feel like at some point that would turn you
insane.
Yeah,
you couldn't see the amount of horrors that the world has to offer forever and ever and ever. You just couldn't. And also humanity, and even if it's a fantasy world, because it happens in fantasy worlds as well, making the same mistakes over and over and over again. Like one of the only reasons that the horrible things that humanity does is almost copable is because it's new humans doing it every time. We never learn. But if you're immortal and you're just seeing them do it over and over again, there's no way you could live with that knowledge. Like, yeah. Immortality is a sad concept, so I find it strange when fantasy novels treat it. Like, I like what you're saying about Name of the Wind, because that is a good reason to be a villain, I think. If you're trapped as immortal, that's a great reason to be a villain.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, yeah, I feel like some fantasy novels treat it as, like, it's great because you get to spend eternity with the person you love. I'm like, no! That's not a good reason to be alive forever. Absolutely not. No.
Yeah.
And also, I do really like the concept... not the concept, but it's written about a lot. There's this one line that I read in a poem once that was, life has a skin of death that keeps its zest, which essentially means that it's the same thing that's in Medium all the time, that life, often you only appreciate everything about it because we are aware of our own mortality, which, yeah, I agree. Like, how can you almost enjoy everything if you think you're going to live forever?
Yeah, it's the same thing as, like, you don't appreciate being happy if you're not sad.
Yes, precisely. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, actually, as I said that, I was thinking of that line in Doctor Who. It's where the Daleks are saying something like, you are weak because you know sadness. And the Doctor's like, that's what makes humans human. That's what makes them beautiful. So yeah, it's that thing of, you cannot appreciate something unless you have the opposite. So you cannot appreciate life if you're not going to die.
Yeah. We rarely reference Doctor Who, considering we both love it.
Yeah, I think it's because we both love it, but we love a certain era of it and haven't. I mean, you did a rewatch recently. I haven't in a long time.
Yeah.
But I'm very excited for the new season.
Same.
I'm almost too excited. I really need to temper it and be like, it might not be great.
I think it's going to be.
And I love Shuti Gatwa. I just love him. I loved him in Barbie.
Yeah.
Although seeing him in Barbie dancing and then like seeing him in Doctor Who, like, oh, I'm just so excited.
Yeah.
McGonagall enters... I didn't need to say it like that. McGonagall enters the room. And I really love how she is immediately in charge. She already has control enough of her grief to know that the school is her responsibility and the pupils are her responsibility. And this is something I adore about McGonagall. And that I think is, I associate with women a lot. And maybe it's just because of different things I've experienced. But to me, it's an almost universal experience, but I could be wrong about that. Of women often... have to control their grief in order to take charge of a situation.
Yep.
And I've seen that over and over again, and I do think it's a very female trait of going, I will grieve later when I am alone, I have to be in charge of this situation.
Yeah.
Which is sad that it's put on women, but I love it for McGonagall in this moment, because at the end of the day, she is in charge of 1,000 pupils and she does have to do this in this moment.
Yeah, I think it also makes it extra sad then when we kind of get to the next book and it's like, she's no longer in charge, like she's that taken away from her.
Oh, yeah.
And I think especially, it's not something that massively upset me growing up reading it, but now as like older woman that's been in the workforce, and it's like, that classic thing that I think most women know that have been in the workforce, where it's like, you've been responsible for something.
Yeah.
And you've been doing a job anyway and yada, yada, yada. And you've maybe even been, you know, like the, you know, because she's like the deputy head.
So right.
You've been like the deputy. And then it ends up just like being given to someone else or whatever.
Yeah.
When it's like, I was doing it anyway, I was next in line, or like any of those number of things. Or like, I headed up this project and then all of a sudden it's been given to someone else.
Yeah.
And like I literally had a thing at the last company where I worked that I came up with this idea to have an internship program for people from underprivileged backgrounds.
Mm.
It was my idea. Like, I pitched it to the founder and got the approval, blah, blah, blah. Started up these, like, meetings. And then this other girl literally was, like, steamrolling, blah, blah, blah. And then she started putting in the meetings and uninvited me from the meetings. And I was so done at that
point. Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Point with the company that I was like, I'm not going to fight for this. But in the end, like, she literally, at some point, I was like, hold on, like, and I just all of a sudden was like, I think I've been uninvited from these meetings. And I was like, this is my project, my idea, and someone else has just come along and uninvited me from the meetings.
Yeah.
And then she got like all of the credit and stuff, and I was like, this was literally my idea that I pitched, and then someone else has just,
yeah, it's happening to me at the moment, and I'm trying to navigate a situation where I stay very involved in it, because I can tell it's trying to be taken off me because it's such a good idea. And I'm like, okay, I need to work out a way to very politely make sure I am kept in the project because it was my idea. I know, yeah. I was the one that came up with it. So,
yeah.
And then because it was such a big idea, like while I was on annual leave, it got taken above my head. And I was like, okay, fair enough, because it is like a big thing. I need to be kept in and everything. Mm. And it is hard to navigate that kind of situation. And yeah. This actually, like, I had this thought when I was reading this chapter, because I thought about the next year when McGonagall is obviously superseded by Snape. And my initial thought was, God, why didn't she quit? And the answer is obvious, because she had to protect the pupils, because the pupils come first. And this is why McGonagall is one of the best characters in Harry Potter, because, you know, like, this would have hurt her so much, but it doesn't matter. Even if she got relegated to fucking caretaker, she is staying at that school. She would stay underground in that school. She would stay as a cat amongst the other cats in that school to make sure every last pupil was safe. But yeah, she's just, oh,
she's,
I love
mother
her. And also, and that is epitomized also all of this in this moment as well, and epitomizes a lot of other themes of this chapter, when she walks in and says Harry. And it's the first time she's ever used his first name, because in this moment, Harry is not a student. He is an equal. He is in the battle with them. He is a member of the Order of the Phoenix, and he is not a child.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, it's her using Harry just epitomizes that.
These like whole chunks of chapters have so much like signaling the end of childhood and yada. And this is like a big one.
Yeah. I love it. Yeah. I love it. And it's such a symbol of like respect from her as well, because although like obviously Dumbledore has been like obviously like the biggest character ever throughout the books, like McGonagall has been there since the first book as such a prominent figure in Harry's life, and he has such deep respect for her. And I love it. And I love the way that comes full circle in book 7 with one of the only times he uses an unforgivable curse to defend her. I just love McGonagall.
Yeah, I am always a sucker for any character that like doesn't have parents and finding the parental figures, and I'm a sucker for it. I just love it as a plot line.
Yeah, and I'm also a sucker for the extremely stern but fair woman who has an absolute heart of gold.
Yeah. Yeah, love it.
Love McGonagall. So the Order of the Phoenix are all completely shocked about Snape. McGonagall, for all her strength, actually has to sit down, have a chair put under her. She almost collapses. Lupin is outraged because not that all of them trusted Snape. They actually don't have a hard time believing that he did it. All of them trusted Dumbledore to the point where if Dumbledore trusted Snape, they believed it. But they come round to it rather quickly.
but it's because they believe Dumbledore, not Snape. And therefore it paints Dumbledore as the fool. And that's really sad because whatever you can throw at Dumbledore, he was not the fool in this situation. He was in control to the end.
Yeah, definitely. I think I've got multiple references and one of them I can't remember, but another would be Succession in terms of telling the story of like getting to a certain age and having people think that you were the fool, that you've like lost your wits and lost your judgment. And definitely one of them is Succession. But there's also another example that's escaping me. But yeah, I think that it's especially when you're someone that has had their career and their reputation built around being very intelligent. Mm. There's kind of nothing worse than getting to the point where it's like people think I'm an old fool. And the fact that Dumbledore was willing, he knew that people would think that he was a fool when Snape unalived him. And he was willing to have his like entire legacy, reputation, like his life, his life's work come down to, oh, he was
trusted
an old fool
the wrong person,
trusted, you know, someone. It, that he wouldn't give up why he trusted Snape, even though a bullshit reason, and that he was willing to do it just so that Draco would maintain his innocence. I know he's a great character, but this is like one of those good moments of Dumbledore because that's like the that's his life work, his entire
it's an entire lack of ego. There's not a shred of ego there. He does. His own legacy does not matter to him. All that matters to him is defeating Voldemort. But in the same way as Harry, it's defeating Voldemort where the individual matters. And I think this comes back around in the next chapter where it's so poignant that Harry asks about Stan Shunpike to the Minister of Magic. And again, Dumbledore is obsessed with saving Draco, one child, one person, but Harry and Dumbledore both think the same way, that one person epitomizes a system. So although Dumbledore is a greater good character, he ruins his entire reputation for Draco.
Yeah, and I think like on the note that you said about ego, I think that Dumbledore's had no like regard for his own ego since the whole Grindelwald thing. I think that for him was like became a point where he was like, I'm not a person that like has this level of like judgment and greatness and blah blah blah, and like from now on like my entire life kind of needs to be repenting for these mistakes that I made. And I think that this definitely contributes to him willingly going to his death knowing he'd look a tit because he's still trying to make up for the mistakes of his youth.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, fucking more people should be like that.
Yeah, and the thing is, like, when you look back at it, he did make massive it makes sense,
he
basically,
done goofed.
why he did that. But he's also regarded as the most powerful wizard in the world, and that he still doesn't ever let that get to him.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, everyone's kind of blaming themselves about Snape, which I mentioned last episode about the whole, like, Neville kind of said, like, Neville was clearly the only one that was a bit like, oh, like, I should have stopped him.
Yes.
Whereas everyone else was like, oh, we just didn't know.
Yeah, and like, yeah, it's, I think it's very accurate that everyone blames themselves because, and it's also like everyone is going through the stages of grief at the moment. And one of the stages of grief is like blame. That is a common stage of grief. So everyone's going through that. But Harry is also, everyone's going through that because Harry has taken on the role of interrogator. And I think, again, it shows how much he is no longer a child in that he is interrogating McGonagall. He is standing and McGonagall is sitting collapsed in a chair. And he is like, what happened? Tell me what happened tonight. Yeah. And then he goes around the room. He's looping what happened. Hermione, what happened? Ron, what happened? And is interrogating each person, not in an aggressive way where he's blaming. Harry never blames anyone because at the end of the day, he blames himself the most. But in the way where he has to understand how this happened.
Yeah. I think it's also a case of like hindsight is 50-50 where the moment they're like, okay, Snape's a bad guy, all of them are like, of course he was a fucking bad guy. Like all of the signs were there.
Yeah.
And the only reason none of them like thought that he was because of their faith in Dumbledore.
Yeah.
And then the moment that faith in him is destroyed by this idea that he was a silly old fool that trusted the wrong man, it immediately makes them like, but the signs were there. We shouldn't have just taken this silly old man's word for it. And it says a lot about the fact that their view of Dumbledore changes in this moment, that kind of gives them that, like, but of course, like, we should have seen it.
Yeah, especially because the only reason Harry... Because it's shown that even McGonagall and Lupin, who in this situation we kind of view as Dumbledore's most trusted seconds, I guess, like, Kingsley should also be in that list, but he's not in the room at the moment, do not know, are never told why Dumbledore trusts Snape. And Harry actually has more information, even though it's the incorrect information. He says, oh, I know, it's because Snape regretted giving the name of my parents. And that's the only information he can give. And they're all like, that's a really flimsy reason. That's nothing. I thought it would be more than that. Yeah. And it is a really flimsy reason because it's not the final reason. The final reason is also fucking flimsy, really, but flimsy. Like, whatever. Let's pretend for a moment that the final reason isn't flimsy. What Harry says is fucking, like, yeah, it makes Dumbledore seem like an idiot because it's no way near good enough. And Harry presents it as, this is the reason Dumbledore told me.
Yeah.
So yeah, they piece together the story of what happened with Harry interrogating each person in turn. So Malfoy got past the DA with the Hand of Glory. Hermione and Luna let Snape go because they needed to help Flitwick. And none of them made mistakes. They only made mistakes in hindsight. Ron is like, I messed up. How did he mess up? He didn't know Draco would have the Hand of Glory. There was, and he was like, I couldn't fire a spell because I'd risked injuring someone. That's smart. Yeah, you're not going to fire a spell into a completely pitch black corridor. You're not going to injure your own people. And yes, Hermione and Luna were guarding Snape, but Lupin points out that if they had tried to stop Snape, he would have murdered them, which he wouldn't have done. I don't know. Snape's grey enough that maybe he would have. Like, all of them are blaming themselves, but none of them actually did anything wrong. It's just all of their actions combined did cause the situation. Then Mr. and Mrs. Weasley and Fleur come in.
They must get so sick of the hospital wing. Fucking again.
Really?
But it's Bill. Why is it Bill this time? I thought he left school. I know we can't really keep track of our children, but I'm pretty sure he left school.
I'm pretty sure. Like, let me just... Oh, yeah. Wait. No, that one left.
Yep.
Mrs. Weasley begins dabbing Bill's fate. Dabbing. I'm just like, dabbing.
We're so cool and down with the kids.
Yeah. Mrs. Weasley begins dabbing Bill's face and she says something which I think from an outside perspective, like, seems selfish, but I do think it's the kind of thing that you say in a moment of grief and horror, which is, it shouldn't matter, but he was so handsome. He was such a handsome boy. And the thing is, I can understand her reaction because when trauma happens, like, the weirdest things come to the surface. And I understand this is her going, I don't know how to process what is in front of me.
Yeah. I also think it's just a very mother of a certain era thing to say.
Yeah.
Like, but I mean, at least it's said about a man, because I feel like this is the kind of thing that would normally be directed at a woman.
Yes, I am glad it's about a man. I think you're right. This whole next section with Miss Sweezy and Fleur is very of its time feminism. And by that, I mean, I think we're going to criticize it, because if it was to be printed now, it's really not that feminist. It's about, like, oh, a woman has finally proved herself to be a good woman because she's seen past the looks of a man. However, when this was printed, in the time it was printed, and knowing J.K. Rowling's politics, it was deemed as like, oh, but this woman is good because... girl power in this moment.
Yeah.
Like, it's very of its... It's very of its time feminism, this next section, I think.
Yeah. And I think it's also sexist in that it's like, this woman is attractive, therefore she must be shallow. And then it's trying to be like, ooh, but she's not actually shallow. And it's like...
she was never shallow. Okay. She was a fucking Triwizard champion.
This might sound like a really random comparison, but it's like, you know Susan Boyle?
I do know Susan Boyle.
Who, for anyone...
not British. I don't think she ever left the British sphere of things.
So it was this thing, like, back in the 2000s when, like, X Factor or it might be Britain's Got Talent was all the rage. But this woman called Susan Boyle auditioned for one of these shows where, like, the... typical thing is it's either like really amazing people or it's these really like delusional people that think that they're like amazing singers aren't. And the thing was is that she was a woman of a certain age who was like classically like unattractive. So, and it's so bizarre to look back on now, but everyone fully went into watching this like, she's not attractive, therefore she's got to be one of these delusional weirdos.
Well, it's also the way they framed it. So like the framing of the show was always the same. The delusional people would come on and the music would start, which you knew meant they were going to be bad, and there would be laugh tracks and there would be people giggling.
But a lot of it was just, oh, she's not attractive, and therefore she must be, you know.
Yeah, but the audience reaction was always cut in. That's not real. So they cut in audience reaction of her, of people being like, so that you would be tricked in this moment into being like,
yeah. But it was this really just weird thing where, as a country, we were like, well, she's fugly, so she's gonna be shit. It's like your physical appearance has absolutely nothing to do with your ability to sing.
But all humans have a bias towards any physical appearance, meaning that we're better at things.
Yeah.
It's been proven time and time and again that it doesn't matter what it is, singing, science, like academia, anything.
I mean, yeah, pretty privilege is a thing.
Yeah.
But anyway, so then obviously it turns out that she's this like fucking incredible singer. But like, I kind of can't remember where my point was going with this now, but like this kind of just reminded me a bit of this, of like, you have preconceptions about someone because of the way that they look. Yeah, it's just a bit like, it's not really feminist to be like, oh, the plot twist here is that the pretty girl isn't shallow. It's like that. No, that's not feminist. That's sexist. Like,
yeah, because also Fleur has proved again and again and again that she isn't shallow and she is brave. She was a Triwizard Tournament. She advocated for Victor and for Cedric during the final task when they were like taken down. She left her family at home so that she could learn English, and then got involved with someone who was part of the Order of the Phoenix. So got involved with someone fully knowing they were in the resistance against Voldemort. She has done nothing to ever prove she isn't brave, but because she's stereotypically pretty, and a lot of the women in this series are not, because that's how J.K. Rowling likes to view people, she's viewed as, oh, well, she must be a bit dim and only obsessed with looks because Bill's really handsome and that's why she's chosen him.
And I mean, it's that classic thing of when you're a woman, you have to be attractive enough to be taken seriously, but if you're too attractive, you're not taken seriously.
Yeah, exactly. On that note, I'm going to make my drink.
Yay.
So I invented this before I read that it had to be song specific. So this is a Fearless Era drink, but I suppose we could call it a fearless drink. And I was going for just kind of throwback. I more went with vibes rather than direct things. So this cocktail has in it lemon juice, white rum, apple cider, bitters, maple syrup. And I just wanted it to feel like Taylor Swift's old country style stuff, and I felt like maple syrup and cider just felt very like American country girl.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to kind of have the feeling of like country Taylor vibes, and also the color is Fearless.
Nice.
Color.
Cheers. Oh, that is lovely. I just love lemon.
It's very lemony. Oh, but I can taste, oh, I'm getting the cider and the maple.
Yeah, so what is in this?
I just read it out.
Didn't listen. Really nice.
Yeah, I really like it. It is giving me the kind of vibe I was going for, like, still a country artist, maybe the first drink you have.
Bit complicated for first drink, but you know. No, it's really nice. I love anything lemony, so.
And I put it in a brown glass as well, so it's very Fearless Era. Country Taylor vibes. I also tried to do a curl of lemon on the side, but I don't know how to make it curly. Fearless. So yeah, in this not very feminist, old feminism moment, Miss Sweezy is dabbing at Bill's face, lamenting that, oh, he was so handsome, it doesn't matter, and he was going to get married. Mm. And Fleur fires into a rage.
I'm so glad she finally stands up for herself.
I'm really glad. This family has been shitting all over her.
As much as I love Mrs. Weasley, she is that stereotypical nightmare mother-in-law.
Literally, she is being like every stereotype ever. And it's like, and for protectiveness, but Fleur has done nothing wrong.
Well, she's been a bit rude at times, but she's just French.
Yeah. Yeah, she has been rude. She was really rude about Christina Warbeck, who Mrs. Weasley really likes.
Yeah, but she doesn't deserve like this level of she's got to break the engagement because he's got scars. Like,
yeah, yeah. And like maybe Mrs. Weasley was thinking like, oh, he'll be too injured for the fact the wedding's in a month or two. But like, it isn't what she means.
No.
So Fleur's like, what do you mean? Of course we're going to get married. Why would this change everything? And I love the fact that she's confident enough to say, I am good looking enough for both of us. Why does it matter? I'm yeah. like, brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Of mm-hmm. course you are. And Mrs. Weasley finally offers the olive branch to Fleur by saying, when Fleur says this and grabs the ointment off her and takes over, Mrs. Weasley says, oh, we've got a beautiful tiara in the family. I think you should wear it. And then they're all confused when the two of them start hugging. I'm like, how did you not see that was the olive branch?
Yeah.
That was the moment. Like, Harry's like, what the fuck?
I'm
like,
men are dumb.
Men are dumb. I'm literally like, well, that was very clearly like, hey, okay, we're doing this.
Yeah. And then I hate it. Then Tom...
It's so out of nowhere. It's so out of nowhere. I expected more build-up rereading it.
It's like as jarring as it was in the film. Thing is, when you watch the film, it's literally like you've been punched around the face and you're like, huh? And then it's somehow just as bad in the book. Like,
and also, Tonks, there's a really rude thing to do in this family moment to go, see?
See? See?
I'm like, not now, Tonks, not now. So yeah,
it's also not the same situation.
No, it isn't. So Tongs is like, see, she loves him. It's the same. So, right, what I couldn't wrap my head around as a child, because maybe I was being dumb, is the fact that this conversation makes zero sense. And what I understand as an adult is clearly this conversation makes sense in the context that they clearly had something happen. They were together for a bit. They had sex, something. And then he broke it off
yeah.
when it got serious. Otherwise, this conversation makes zero sense if they haven't been in some sort of relationship situationship yeah. already. Like, yeah. it just doesn't.
Yeah.
That's the only explanation. And I didn't really get that as a child.
Yeah, it just...
Also, everyone knows Mr. and Mrs. Weasley are giving their opinions. I'm like, this is so unsubtle.
Yeah. It, like, I am... And I never was... any kind of maraudership or anything like that. I don't know how I didn't see it, but like I just didn't see it originally. So this is not coming from some biased like thing of like, oh, like really wanting Lupin to be gay and whatnot. But I just, it feels like the opposite of only gays in the village, in that it's like, what are the only two? It's like she's clearly had this reaction where she doesn't like the shipping, doesn't want him to be gay, blah, 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 and has gone, who is the only remotely age-appropriate, but not really, woman that's single? Tonks. Because, I'm sorry, what do these characters have in common?
They're like both fighting Voldemort?
Like, that's it. We don't see them interact. We didn't even know that they knew each other prior to this conversation. Like,
no, that was the thing. This would make so much more sense if... it clearly wasn't added into this book last minute. If in book 5 we had seen some flirt, because also the only way the timelines make sense is if this fling that I mentioned, this something, happened during book 5. So for that setup to be there, we needed some sort of flirty banter in book yeah. 5. We need a little bit of something
that, or
so
even,
this makes sense.
Even have the bit at the end when they're in the ministry, something about
Lupin jumping in front to save her, Tonks
yeah,
jumping in front to save him.
Being overprotective, something like that. But it just comes out of fucking nowhere.
Yeah.
And it feels like... they have so little in common, and there's just like, it's just like, huh, what? That it's, it just feels like she was like, shit, what hetero couple, you know, can I make? And yeah, it just feels like the opposite of only gays in the village.
And also, she's very aware that this is a weird couple, because textually, Lupin says, I'm too old for you. So she's about 23, I think, and he's about 39, I think.
Yeah, which is... not the world's most horrendous.
It's not the world's most horrendous thing.
But,
I'm fine with it,
but
if it's not these two.
Yeah, I would be fine with it if they literally had anything in common or we'd ever seen them talk to each other before. But it's just weird when you're not given anything else to support it that I'm like, I don't buy that someone that's 23 is going to have something in common with a 40-year-old if you've not shown me it.
The only other it's to force two people who were coded as homosexual thing. The other reason I can give that she did this is because she realised she wanted a plotline in book seven where Harry is godfather for the massive parallels, which does become an important part of book seven.
Yeah.
Of the parallels of Teddy not having parents, Harry being the godfather, things like that. And I do really like that part. Not it being like Tonks and Lupin's baby, because that bit gets even more messier, but Harry having this responsibility of being a godparent, the massive parallels there, how he sees himself as reckless, how much he knows he needs to be there for Teddy. I do like that part, and it's like there's no one else. It kind of has to be Lupin, because there's no one else who would name Harry as godparent, so that's another reason why it's forced in. They would not name Harry. He's got so many brothers. Why would he name Harry as godparent?
Fleur saved her sister.
Oh, that's a good point.
And like, I don't know, you don't make siblings godparents.
Some people do. I don't know.
I don't know.
I'm not christened.
Yeah. I mean, neither am I. But like, I don't know.
You have godparents, don't you?
Unofficially. It's not like an actual, they're just like, the same when your parents' friends are your aunt and uncles, but
I don't have godparents, so no. I don't really know.
Yeah. Your siblings are already there, aunt and uncles.
Right, okay, godparents aren't normally family. Okay, fair enough. So yeah,
I could be wrong about that.
It could be Bill and Fleur's baby, I think. But yeah, I think she realised there needed to be a baby in book seven to kind of raise the stakes, and that could be another explanation for it. But it's still not good enough to not have the setup in book five if you're going to do it.
It's so jarring.
Yeah, it's so jarring.
It's so bad. And also, I'm sorry, he's gay, she's a lesbian. It's so clear. Like, Tonks is not straight. I'm sorry. It's just, it feels like we've missed a scene where they both get forced to go to, like, conversion therapy. Like, yeah, you know?
Yeah, and I almost expected it to feel less jarring than I was expecting, because I was like, maybe we've overhyped this, and I literally turned the page this morning, I was reading the chapter, and I was like, nope, that's jarring, Jesus yep. Christ, what is going on?
Yep.
So McGonagall asked to speak to Harry in her office. She's like, come to my office.
Before this, Hagrid had to move Dumbledore's body. I'm sorry, but like, that's horrible. And also, could they not have just floated it?
I'll talk about this in the next chapter. I find it really fucking weird that the dead body's being carried down the aisle, not in a coffin.
Yeah.
Can you imagine that at a normal funeral for a second? There's a reason why we use coffins.
It also then becomes a matter of what speed is appropriate. Because too slow, weird. Too fast, whee!
Yeah, it's just... And also, yeah, are you just picking Hagrid because he's strong? Because he's very emotional right now.
It's like...
It's a lot of responsibility to put on him.
And, like, I know we then get the parallel on the next book when he thinks he's holding Harry's butt. But I'm just like, I feel like there were other ways to move the body that didn't involve poor Hagrid.
I know.
Ugh.
I'm so traumatised right now. On the topic of Dumbledore's body... Harry walks into the office.
Body oddy oddy.
Body oddy oddy. Harry walks into the office and he's like, oh, it looks the same. I almost expected something to be different, like black veils or Dumbledore's body in there. I was like, sorry, one of your thought processes was, what if his body is just laying on the desk?
They're actually just doing Weekend at Bernie's.
Honestly, I was like, what? Why would you think that? I mean, where have they put the body? That is a question, but it's not just going to be lying on his desk, is it?
I mean, I can totally buy... You know how, like, cruise ships have to have morgues, because...
All cruise ships have morgues, yes.
I think, obviously, Hogwarts would. Like, they lose, like, dozens of students a year.
Yeah, there's definitely a morgue.
There's got to be somewhere for the body.
Yeah.
Hogwarts has a morgue. Did a house elf hang the portrait? Because...
It magically hung itself.
Did it?
Yes.
Did it?
Yes.
I
wonder when they pose for them.
Yeah.
How long into your... Is it as soon as you become headmaster, you get it painted?
And
I would assume so. In case
again,
you drop
every 10 years.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. It has to be up to date. So, yeah.
But, like, I don't know. I kind of love the idea of, like, the house elves having some little alarm, like, oh, Dumbledore's dead.
Let me get the portrait out.
Get the portrait out. Get the hammer and the nail. And, boop, boop, boop.
And also, yeah, because it must have happened almost instantaneously. It's been, what, an hour, two? And the portrait's up.
They're fucking on it.
Tell you what kind of annoys me in this chapter is the portrait is very asleep, okay? And we hear not a peep out the portrait. Not a single peep. And in the next book, the portrait becomes so sentient that it is instructing people left, right, and centre. Which, A, I don't think a portrait should be doing. A portrait... Okay, so yes, it's a capture of the person in life and Dumbledore had a lot of information. But in my opinion, in book 7, the portrait is too sentient. It's giving too many instructions. Yes. So why in this book, if it is going to be that sentient in book 7, is it just like, I'm just going to sleep through this conversation. I don't fucking care.
Yeah, it's the portrait thing is like a can of worms.
It's just a huge can of... It's book 7 that ruins it. I was pretty happy up until book 7 with how the portraits work.
Yeah, it's just there's so many of these cases of J.K. Rowling's world building where she opens a can of worm without doing the work to be like, okay, if I'm going to have time travel or these portraits, blah, 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 that I need to define at least in my own head for the sake of consistency. Because I get you don't have to literally spell out all of the possible lore and rules and stuff, but she quite obviously has so many of these things where she hasn't worked it out for herself, so can't like keep it straight within the narrative. And this is one of those things I'm like, if you're gonna put this in there, you need to define it. Sorry, what I got distracted by was, so Neil and Hannah have this like art that's like a record made of words.
It's Neil's, not mine,
and
I don't take responsibility for sharing this with him.
Okay. And then I just, my eyes fell on it, and because it's a bit far away, I just completely, there's a bit where it's like it's got two separate words, yeet and huge, that have ended up next to each other, but because I'm a bit far away, I read it as huge teat.
And I was like, I can see what you're reading, yeah.
I was like,
So this was made by a friend of Neil's. I could get up and show it to you, but I'm not going to because I can't be bothered. This was made by a friend of Neil's, and it is a collection of things he says a lot, which my favorite bit is the massive bit that says, ask me anything about eggs.
Yes.
So yeah, it's a collection of things he says a lot, especially in university. So from here I can read.
He's not changed. He's not changed. Just say.
Sure, Jan. Big sad. Ask me anything about eggs. Fancy the pub. I cannot stress this enough. Yeet. Brilliant. Huge. And then there's all sorts of other things on there.
Yeah. Including huge teat.
Huge teat. But yeah, it's not normally where it is, so Charlie's eyes have been drawn to it. But yeah, it's... The portraits up until the end of this book have felt somewhat like how I can understand them, in that the way they are, they don't seem sentient enough for me to feel super sorry for them. They seem like a cartoon, like a game thing where it's got a set amount of lines. Do you know what I mean? Like, obviously they have emotions. The fat lady got scared. But it's like a magic eight ball. Like, it's got a limited amount of emotions and reactions. And then in book 7, we get Dumbledore's fucking portrait telling everyone to do everything. It cries at Harry, like, no, you've ruined it right at the end. You've made it too sentient.
Yeah, it's like, kind of how I think it should be is that it has the personality of the person and obviously like enough contextual memories to not be like, hey, who the fuck are you? But like, it shouldn't be like, and here is the deepest lore.
No,
you know?
No, like, it should be like a magic eight ball, like kind of like if you took a photo of someone and had to write down their top 4 personalities traits.
If you had to make a piece of art of the common things that they say.
Exactly. Exactly. That's how the portrait should work. And it does, it is kind of like that up until book 7. And it annoys me when she just, and the reason why she does it is because she couldn't work out any other way to do all the plot stuff she needed to
I'm
do. And
now
that pisses me off.
Just picturing a portrait of Neil going, sure, Jan.
Ask me anything about eggs.
Brilliant.
It's kind of like a parrot that can only say, can't parrots only say 40 words?
We have always had this running joke in my family that when my mum dies, we're just going to replace her with like a tape recording of herself. Because honest to God, she's got about 40 things that she just says on loop. And every now and then we kind of think of another, like she'll say it, or one of us will say it. And then we're like, that's another for the tape recording.
What makes me laugh about your parents, and I'm sure it's the same with all parents, I've just spent the most time with your parents in the last few years recently, is they both have very distinct ways of saying your name that are very easy to do impersonations of.
Go on then, I'm curious.
Your dad is always like, Charlotte.
He sounds so disapproving.
He is all the time. He's trying to, not disapproving, he's trying to explain things to you all the time.
Oh, he did a great one. Oh, what did he? He rang me the other day and said something so fucking obvious.
And your mum goes, Charlie.
Yeah, she does do that. My dad is like the worst mansplainer. Like, I don't understand.
I don't think he knows he's doing it. I don't think he knows he's doing it.
No, he doesn't, but like, it's just his view of me. He explains things so simple that it's like how to breathe oxygen. And I'm like, I don't understand how you think that I've like gotten to this point. I can't think of the one that he did the other day, but like two like relatively recent ones. The other day I was asking him how he's got like a weird barbecue that's like more of a grill thing and it's like gas powered. So I was like, Dad, like, will you show me how this works? And he was like, yes, yeah, so never turn it on inside. And I'm like,
what
do you think is wrong with me? I'm not gonna light a barbecue inside. And then the best one, genuinely the best one that I think he's ever done is he gets a bit anxious when I travel alone, even though I'm 28. And he always likes to ring me before I'm like going through the airport and stuff to like make sure I know what I'm doing. And I'm happy to humour him. But he rang me at one point and he was like, yeah, so when you go through passport control, they'll want to know your last name. That's Ward. This was only about a year ago. I was like,
I know, because he'd done it in front of me when we've like, been on holiday together.
I'm like, I'm 28. I know my last name. Why don't you think I know my last name?
It's very sweet.
It is. It's really sweet. Like, he doesn't mean it, but like, it's just like, how do you think I survive? So yeah, McGonny is like,
McGonny!
Yeah, is like, yo, Harry, what were you two up to? And Harry's like, soz, bruv. Not going to tell you.
Yeah.
So this is word for word.
It is. So she reverts to calling him Potter because of this, which I thought had threefold reasons.
Oh, God.
One, yes, we're all hyping the fact that she calls him Harry throughout this chapter, but as a first-time reader, you don't actually notice until she says Potter, because the way you read, you wouldn't notice that sort of thing. So it shows you that for the rest of this chapter, she's been calling him Harry. Two, why did I write one and two is the same? Two, she's also trying to regain power in this situation because Harry, for most of the chapter, has been kind of one-upping the power on everyone else. She's been like, what were you doing? What were you doing? I'll tell you the information. So she's trying to reassert some power back in the situation. But three, I also think it shows that Harry is actually being childish in this situation. So she's reverting to using the name she calls him as a pupil because he's following Dumbledore's instructions to a pig-headed level, in my opinion. Like, yes, Dumbledore said don't tell anyone, but Harry, until right at the end of book 7, doesn't really question, and I don't think really throughout the books, that he can make his own decisions that do not revolve around what Dumbledore laid out for him. And I think that Harry comes to the realization that Dumbledore never did, that he can trust people and he does have a really good judgment of people and should let people in. Like, the kind of whole Harry's side of the battle is kind of meant to be this coming together of misfits and miscreants and the people at the fringes of society who Voldemort can never represent, that Harry can implicitly trust because they're never going to go over to the dark side because they never can be on the dark side. And I think that we are shown that Dumbledore's failings is not sharing enough information around. Like, we can view it as a good thing, but at the end of the day, Harry loses faith in Dumbledore halfway through book 7 because he was constantly keeping his cards too close to the chest. And I think Harry is being almost childish in this chapter for not analysing his reason for not wanting to tell people. He's only going off Dumbledore's orders.
I think in some ways I disagree with you. I do agree that Harry should really have a moment to be like, hey, I can probably tell McGonagall. Obviously, he needs to make sure it is McGonagall first.
Yeah. Or also, maybe I should think about if I can tell McGonagall and decide that for myself.
Yeah, but I don't think I agree with the rest of what you say. Like, one, yeah, like, there are some of them that are, like, the outcasts who would never go to the dark side. But for the most part, like, you know, it's not the most diverse set of books. Mm. And there's a lot of them that are, like, pure or half-bloods that are, you know, white human beings, etc., etc. So that could. And I also think that I've always considered it a massive shame that Harry doesn't get betrayed by someone, purely in terms of, I think the reoccurring theme that we see throughout the book is Harry having this like complete blind faith in his friends in the same way that James did. And James then got betrayed.
Yeah.
And I just, it's not necessarily that I think it's a shame. It's that I truly believe that this is a dropped plot, because I just think there's a lot of foreshadowing for it. And yeah, I think it would have been an interesting element to have that kind of like full circle, it mirroring his father, you know, these themes of Harry being blindly trusting and Dumbledore trying to encourage him not to be and stuff. And it just feels a bit, I guess, anticlimactic in a way.
Yeah, I see what you mean. I think it could have been a very interesting element of the story. I think what I want isn't done to the extent I want it, which is that still at the end of book 7, Dumbledore's plan is revealed as being perfect and Harry never really works it out and thinks for himself. And what I want is, although Dumbledore, you know, did have everything figured out, once he's dead, it has to fall with Harry. And if he wants to change the way it's done, that's his decision.
Yeah.
And he should feel the freedom to do that, because although he is Dumbledore's man through and through, he is his own person who can make his own decisions.
Like, I think we've had this conversation before. I mean, once again, it's J.K. Rowling not really wrapping up the shit that she starts, but about how Harry starts to have this crisis of, I didn't know things about him, he lied to me and he manipulated me, only for that to literally not come to her head.
Yeah.
It's just like, okay, all's forgiven and that's fine, I just followed his path. It would have been interesting to see, I guess, the final result be a version of Dumbledore's plan, but not exact. And that, like, it, the differentiation being Harry slightly taking it in a different direction.
Yeah.
And it's still working out, but Harry actually being like, you know what? Dumbledore didn't know everything. He didn't trust me with these things. And, you know, I can make my own decisions. And maybe he does it in a slightly different way than Dumbledore intended. Maybe the good point for that would have been the Deathly Hallows, because of how Dumbledore kind of added it in this like last minute, not very well thought out thing. And whilst I do really like what happens, obviously, with the wand, it's really, really smart and it's like a make or break moment. It would have been, I think that would have been the interesting one for Harry to make the judgment call against what Dumbledore wanted.
Yeah.
As much as I do like the whole wand ownership thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm kind of waffling at this point, but yeah, it would have been interesting to see Harry maybe getting betrayed and also Harry deviating from the narrative that Dumbledore, because yeah, she just sets up a lot of like, a lot of foreshadowing that Harry will get betrayed, as well as a lot of, I was halfway through, I mean, I was almost at the end, so I'm not going to finish my point because I was pretty much talking in circles and then the camera cut out.
When do we not talk in circles? So the other heads of houses come in and they discuss closing the school next year. Which, how would that help? Explain to me how that would help.
It's such an overreaction. You don't close the only school in the country.
It's the only school!
Because the headmaster died.
And also it's like, well, you know, will the pupils want to come back? Okay. One, yes, they can be homeschooled, but yes, some of them will. Two, it's the only school in the country. How are they going to take their exams? Like, yeah, they could take them privately at home. But three, as Hagrid points out through his metaphor of his own life, this is the only home for a lot of pupils. It is a boarding school. And all the Muggle-born... What about the Muggle-born children? Like, yeah, they're not allowed in next year. Let's just disregard what Voldemort does next year.
Yeah.
What are you talking about?
Yes, it makes no sense. So, like, the school's not shut when other headmasters have died. Like, what the fuck are you on about?
Because a teacher murdered another teacher. Okay, so you're still the only school. And, like, yeah. Okay, so let's just say you close next year, right? And let's just say, okay, because next year Voldemort doesn't educate all the Muggle-borns. So, yes, there's an entire year group of Muggle-borns who will have to start school age 12. Fine, that happens anyway. But let's say you do it without it being Voldemort's reign. So what? None of those Muggle-borns get their letter. And what, does that just mean they never find out they're a wizard? Or do you then invite them to come a year older? Like, the system breaks down where you're the only school in the country.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Also, I'm sorry, but Snape ejaculated Slughorn. Never a good enough reason to say ejaculated.
Snape!
Snape!
McGonagall's then like, we'll send them all home tomorrow. And Harry's like, what about the funeral? Which, like, okay, yeah, it is a bit weird that the funeral's taking place on school grounds, but this I can get over. Like, fair enough. He gave his life to the school, whatever. So yeah. Harry is the one that convinced them all that the school should stay open until the funeral.
Yes.
Because they should be allowed to grieve, say their goodbyes. And it's again showing the adultness of this, that Harry's allowed to stay for the conversation to give his opinion along with the other heads of houses. And it's his opinion that ends up being the right one.
Especially when we've had this reoccurring thing of him being cut out of the conversations. And then now he's being allowed in. And again, the loss of childhood, yada, yada.
Like, the thing is, it should never be a shock in the next chapter when Harry says he's not coming back. Like, I think it was a shock the first time I read it because this is all subtext and I was like however old and didn't understand subtext, but reading it back, it's just so obvious he's gonna say he's not gonna come back to school. It's so obvious this is his final time in Hogwarts.
Yeah
Also, to add to that, because Harry also says the students should be allowed to stay, so he sees himself as outside the students. In referring to them as the students, he doesn't see himself as a member of them anymore, which also adds to that. So Harry goes back to the common room. I don't know why I always do this. And it's bustling with people. It's really busy. But Harry notices that Dean and Seamus are down there. He hopes and is right about the fact that when he goes up to his dormitory, it is only Ron there. And I just love this, like, Ron knows what Harry needs in this moment, which is he's not going to greet him at the door. It's the quiet of just them two in the dormitory. Mm-hmm. And Ron just sits there and waits for Harry to speak, like, okay then. I find it surprising that Hermione isn't up there though, knowing that she can get into the boys' dormitories. Was she just like, yeah, I'm going to bed, like, I don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
She's probably with Ginny, presumably. Harry tells Ron that the locket is fake, and then Harry notices that Fawkes is no longer singing and has left the grounds forever, and Harry sees that as a symbol for his own aloneness.
So sad.
Too bad, so sad.
That was dramatic.
I know, I like to be dramatic.
Do you want to ask me a question? How much wood would the woodchucker chuck if the woodchucker could chuck wood?
10,000 chucks.
Cool.
Great.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Goblet of Wine. To find us on social media, search at Goblet of Wine Pod on Twitter or at Goblet of Wine Podcast on Instagram. We also have a website over at www.gobletofwine.co.uk where you can keep up with everything that we do. This podcast is produced by our wonderful Hufflepuff tier patrons.
Yolanda, Sir Bandersnatch, Samuel, Patrick, Michael, Kylie, Cara and Molly, Jasmine, Florian, Ashling, and Ash.
If you'd like to support this podcast, check out our Goblet of Wine Patreon, where you can also gain access to bonus episodes, behind the scenes content, and our Discord. Thank you so much for listening to this episode, and we'll see you in the next one.
Bye.